episode of Delayed, live from Ed City. We're here this evening with Professor Dalia Judovits from Emory University. Dalia, you are in the Department of French and Italian, I see here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Your specialty, or at least what we're going to be talking about tonight, is Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah.
And how did your interest in Duchamp come about originally?
It's a good question. Well, in a way, it's hard to think about a moment one isn't interested in Duchamp, but I spent some time in Philadelphia.
Étant donné.
Étant donné, exactly. And that work really puzzled me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, a lot of the other works, the ready-mades, really interested mm-hmm. me as well. So that stuff was on my radar.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of years later, somebody asked me to do something on anemic cinema, mm-hmm. on the little film that he did in 26 mm-hmm. with Man Ray and Marc
mm-hmm.
Allegre,
mm-hmm.
which is a set of verbal and visual puns, abstract film, set of rotating kind of spirals.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so puzzled by the work and what the heck was going on in it that it really started, I started sort of reading a lot more mm-hmm. and thinking about him. And then eventually I was commissioned actually to write a piece on Étant donné.
Mm.
At that point, I realized that Étant donné was like an inventory, was like a compendium,
mm-hmm.
that what Duchamp was always doing in his works, he's always restaging and putting his works together, and there was this whole rich kind of cross-referencing, so that by the time I finished sort of looking at that piece, I realized that I'd actually written the conclusion to a book.
Mm.
So it was kind of strange, because the first mm-hmm. book on Duchamp, I sort of wrote the Étant donné, is really a kind of conclusion from mm-hmm. which I went forward. The last chapter I wrote was chapter one.
Mm.
I kind of made my way back from installation art mm-hmm. into the origins of kind of pictoriality.
Mm.
And actually, I was also interested in the fact that, his training was more as a printer than a painter,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of an interesting fact.
Can you say a little bit? Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are most of the people listening, mm-hmm. of course, to this know who Marcel Duchamp was. But for those who might have a passing acquaintance
mm-hmm.
With him, can you give a short precis of I guess most people consider him like a conceptual artist. He
right.
did installations, did paintings, all sorts of things, right?
Well, it's more than he did these things, let's say, that nobody had ever done, or practically
mm-hmm.
he invented the genres.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, what's really unusual about him is that each time, when you look at, what's interesting is the dates. When you look at the ready-mades, basically, by 13, 14, 15, this is a very early time. I mean, what's happening in art is everybody's heading off into cubism and doing abstraction and so on. And this guy goes to a hardware store, picks up a couple of items, like a bottle rack and a snow mm-hmm. shovel and a comb, a dog comb.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts sort of looking at what makes these – starts asking sort of questions about art. But to ask questions about art by actually not turning to painting or not turning towards abstraction, as everybody, like cattle, was doing mm-hmm. at the early part of the century, is to have really done something extraordinary, because mm-hmm. it's so early on. And then if you look at his gestures, like something like the Underwood sort of typewriter case,
mm-hmm.
it's like the first example of soft art.
Mm-hmm.
So each time when you look at the datations, like he does an installation or the elements already of an installation by basically about, what was it? I guess about 1917.
Mm-hmm.
And then does actual kind of formal installations in the surrealist shows in the 30s and then 40s, but he's considered also to be the father of installation mm-hmm. art. So the interesting thing with him is that it's not that he sort of does these things, it's that he sort of comes up in a mm-hmm. way for the ideas and the conditions.
And also one of the first people, I don't know, but one of the first to do mm-hmm. what we might think of now was identity art or transgressive art with a sense of Rose Selavy, and could you speak a little bit about that aspect of his? There's a famous photograph of Rose.
Yes, yes. Signed affectionately, yours, Marcel Duchamp. It's a very interesting picture because it's a picture of Duchamp in masquerade, basically disguised as a woman, very nicely made up, mm-hmm. wearing a fur coat. He borrowed the hands of Picabia's, I can't remember what it was. I think it was Picabia's wife, I think Germaine Everling. And so the hands that you see, actually, I mean, she's actually embraces him from the back. So okay. He literally kind of borrows her hands. And and I would say this is more than just a joke, kind of, because it sort of comes to mark the form of the forms of appropriation that he's involved in as much as he had earlier taken the Mona Lisa, put a mustache and goatee, added the little caption below, and issued this work as as an original, basically. He later then shaved the Mona Lisa. He did Mona Lisa shaved in the 60s. Where he had the Mona Lisa without the mustache and goatee and just had El Ashoku shaved. So,
it's uncanny the way that he presaged or formed these various genres as you're talking. You know, also the photos that were called, I can't remember the
compensation portraits.
Compensation portraits, yeah,
yes.
Where you were supposed to have a photo. Portrait of someone who was like yourself, I guess, or whom you thought you had some affinity with, or no affinity with.
Or no affinity with. That's right. In some cases, actually.
Yeah. So he was there before a lot of people.
Before Sherry Levine and many, many others.
Yeah.
I mean, this whole question of appropriation is really important because it emerges out of this whole idea of trying to question the idea of authorship and the unity. I mean, he moves away from all the psychological and expressive understanding of art towards understanding the artist really in the mode of a multiple. The artist doesn't have some kind of essence. Identity is a set of adopting postures, positions. It's multiple. It changes. It's a construction.
Right, and speaking of multiples, he also did the valise series, the suitcase series, or... can you talk a little bit about that? We could just sort of cover a lot of these different aspects before we talk about, you know.
Well, the suitcase is a very interesting work because it's sort of a work that begins to develop just as World War II. He sort of starts thinking about that work around 35. And already in Europe, basically the sense that the war may be coming, the sense of tension is accumulating. So he comes up, it's a very moving work in a way because it also has an interesting history, but it captures his own kind of nomadic status because if you recall, he came to America during the First World War. So he was a kind of refugee, if you want to call him. He was both a war, and in fact he becomes a kind of art refugee in as much as in coming to New York he decides to leave painting behind and start doing something else. So that the coming to the U.S. in 1915 marked not just the break with leaving his country behind, but with the idea of art. He says, I'm so glad I haven't done any paintings since I came over. So the valise is kind of interesting because he worked with other artists. He basically commissioned that. It's a very conceptual work because he commissioned other artists and got help in producing miniaturized reproductions of all of his works. Some he produced himself. He produced the prototypes very painstakingly. So they're very carefully handmade, and they're reproduced sort of painstakingly by hand by other artists. But they represent a kind of inventory. It's like a little miniature museum of his works.
Of course, ironically enough, now, I guess Sotheby's, these boxes, cases... bicycle seats, bicycle wheels go for like many, many, many thousands, if not millions of dollars in some cases. Do you think that was somewhat at odds with his whole, was he anti-capital in some sense, or would he just didn't care about it?
Excellent question. I mean, no, he simply was aware that art took place in market conditions. And he obviously was not... he was interested in questioning that, but it was a very astute, a kind of deconstructive form of questioning because he didn't think that we could ever escape that kind of commercial. The fact that art functions in the modality of the commodities, he says at one point in one of his quotes, he said, "A work of art are like checks, and they're sort of exchanged like commodities."
He drew a check, right, for a dentist, that he had some dentist work done. I don't know exactly the story behind that.
It was called the Tsang check.
Which presages also this guy who draws money now.
Yes, exactly, J.S.D. Boggs. Yes.
Exactly, right.
So exactly.
He's everywhere. Duchamp is everywhere that you want to be as an artist, which is disconcerting, I must say. An artistic point of view to have someone already there before you.
Except that I think that what shouldn't be so disconcerting is that he's there in a very playful and whimsical kind of way. He's not there. He's there more as a relay. He's there to engage you. He's there to provoke you. He's there almost. It's a little bit like the box itself in the valise. It's an invitation basically to play with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's because a lot of his works are about forms of activation, so that the box, the way that actually the work doesn't exist for you unless you actually physically open it up with your hands mm-hmm. and take out the pieces, you mm-hmm. kind of unfold the stuff. So that I think what is interesting in Duchamp is that it's not so much about gestures of authority
mm-hmm.
as what he's trying to do is move the concept of art into a kind of, to not be about objects, mm-hmm. so that it's not simply about the way that it's bought and sold. It's really about its capacity to engage. Because he used to say the spectator makes the picture.
You have some nice phrase in here.
Yeah.
It's about the iterability of gesture rather than the fetishization of the object.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Let me back up a second and ask you a quote here. Mm-hmm. About talk about trauma in art and catastrophe, because I have an interest in those,
okay.
as we all do, I guess, to some degree in the 20th century or the mm-hmm. early 21st century. In speaking of some of his production, you say, mm-hmm. affirming its affinity with child's play mm-hmm. rather than with the seriousness of making art, this work postpones the artistic becoming of art in response to the catastrophic events of modern history. Can you speak a bit about the relationship of trauma to his work and maybe even the relationship of trauma to art production in general, or as Freud called it, like troglodyte, I guess, delaying aspect of art, which raises another question,
mm-hmm. yes.
nestle another question inside
yes.
here, of Ezra Pound, who said that, you know, artists were our poets were the antenna of the race. But in this mm-hmm. viewpoint, artist would be would be behind these signals that are coming forward, and that the culture itself is ahead of the artist. That the catastrophe has already happened. The artist sort of missed it in a way, and now has to respond in this traumatic fashion. And that at some point you allude here postpones the mm-hmm. artistic becoming, mm-hmm. which says to me that there will be a point in history at which art will be ahead of the game again, or
deferred perpetually. Yeah.
Right.
Because it can no longer have aesthetic meaning. It can mm-hmm. no longer exist the way that it existed priorly,
mm-hmm.
so that its capacity to attain the forms of meaning it had prior
mm-hmm.
have been basically deferred
mm-hmm.
And are no longer in some way reachable, because what he's also interested in is promoting an idea of process.
Mm-hmm.
An understanding of art as interaction, as process, and in that sense open to notions of becoming rather than some kind of essence or reproducing some kind of an event.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the question you raise is a very interesting one, and I should say that when I started writing that little article on Duchamp and World War II, it came out of a kind of question mark for myself, because on some level it seems silly. Here's this guy. He's going to Europe. The people have been working on these boxes that he's put together, kind of compendium. Mm-hmm. It would seem kind of self-involved that he was putting his work together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Although artists often in the face of war found themselves trying to put their works together and trying to simply get out of the country, as almost everybody. Mm-hmm. All the surrealists were doing this at this time, Man Ray, Breton. Everybody was trying to flee basically to the south of France. And Duchamp has a cheese dealer pass. And instead of carrying cheese, mm-hmm. yes, instead of carrying cheese around, he's carrying these boxes. But what I thought was interesting, this sort of opened up, you know, like what is he doing with this cases sort of with these suitcases, basically. And what kind of gesture is that in the face of war, in the face of catastrophe? And so I began to think, I found almost no scholarship in this area. So I found myself sort of alone trying to go back into some of the early correspondence mm-hmm. to kind of reconstruct basically what's going on, and discovered that Duchamp always, that part of, in a way, his whole trajectory as an artist is somehow linked to questions of war, to questions of military service, for instance, that as a way of deferring his military service, not deferring, as a way of doing his military service, he became an art worker,
mm-hmm.
which was a special category in France that you did, and he learned how to become a printer, interestingly enough. And so Duchamp actually was not supposed to, in World War I, for instance, he was given deferral because he had some kind of a health condition. But he was extraordinarily, the correspondence of the period indicates that he was very much struck by the sense of grief, by the magnitude, and the way that he describes it is a kind of universal grief, he says, that's beyond the kind of purview of any one individual. So that there's a sense that this magnitude sort of overloads. This magnitude is beyond our own capacity in human experience to make claims on it. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit what Benjamin...
I just was thinking of that as I was doing the relationship with Benjamin.
Yeah, with Walter Benjamin. Benjamin said, you know, weird thing about soldiers in World War One. They came back, but they had nothing to tell. Mm-hmm. You think that they would keep talking. They would have so many stories. But mm-hmm. they had no stories because there's a way in which the experience so much... basically blew their experiential frameworks, mm-hmm. I mean, so much shattered mm-hmm. their frames of reference that they basically did not know how to claim and couldn't, in a way, the violence of this experience, didn't quite know how to sort of claim it. So,
to the extent that Benjamin himself said mm-hmm. that the experience was on the wane, was disappearing in some sense. So the traditional kind of experience through storytelling and a more embodied kind of experience.
Exactly.
So it's a very similar kind of thing here.
Exactly. And so the question then in Duchamp is this kind of a work, a more indirect way of trying to address these questions, mm-hmm. Not by trying to pretend to represent events, mm-hmm. Not by trying to, for instance, at one moment in the catalog that he does for the Surrealist exhibit, what is interesting that he put together with Breton, what is interesting about the catalog is that there are no pictures. Basically, of the war. There's only mm-hmm. one picture of destruction of... Or you see a city that's been strafed. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, there's no trace whatsoever, and yet you know that there's tremendous carnage going mm-hmm. on, so that there is an attempt to sort of withhold from traditional forms of representation or the traditional conceit that you can just photograph violence or you can, simply represent traumatic mm-hmm. events.
Which is certainly an aspect of the traumatic experience, where the traumatic experience is not represented directly, but is repressed, sublimated, or turned into another kind of thing, which then pops out at some mm-hmm. point in the future.
And is addressed in a more indirect. I mean, mm-hmm. if there is any way to sort of for it to be addressed, it is more through the fact that this event is, that aspects mm-hmm. or fragments of this event are repeated, and there's a much more indirect way of trying to address it.
Right. Let's take a short break here. I think we're almost to that point, and then we'll come back and talk about... I mentioned this to you before we had a conversation. A book that I've read by Philip Reeve called My Life Among the Death Works. And Philip Reeve, of course, has a sort of a cathected reputation. I'll put it that way, even with myself. But I was intrigued by some things in this book that takes the Duchamp legacy in a somewhat different arena. And, you know, in our discussion about trauma, mm-hmm. It definitely fits into that in the, I guess you could say, what would seem to be the approaching realm of nihilism at the time of World War One, World mm-hmm. War II, beginning from Nietzsche, but definitely mm-hmm. even Freud mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. from then on. So... anyway, let's take a short break, and then I would like to read you a quote from Philip Reeve, and then we can sort of talk about that for a few minutes.
All right.